Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we learn about the emerging science of body movement. We've long known the health benefits of exercise and activity, but even devoted fitness buffs who work out every day can spend a good portion of the rest of their day chained to a desk and in physical inactivity. And that sedentary activity has been linked to anxiety, depression, and lower intellectual and cognitive brain function over time. In her book, Move, science journalist Caroline Williams speaks with neuroscientists, evolutionary biologists, psychologists, and health researchers to hear the latest information on the benefits of movement. She finds that humans are hardwired to move, and whether it's walking to spur creativity, strength training to build emotional resiliency, dancing, which stimulates brain function across a whole range of intellectual areas, or core training, which can relieve stress, spending more time in movement is good for our intellectual and emotional brain function. Caroline Williams is a consultant and regular contributor to New Scientist magazine and has written for The Guardian and BBC Earth. She's been a producer and reporter for BBC Radio and is the author of the previous book, My Plastic Brain, One Woman's Year-Long Journey to Discover If Science Can Improve the Mind. And her new book, published by Hanover Square, is titled Move, How the New Science of Body Movement Can Set Your Mind Free. Caroline Williams, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's begin by just talking about the science of body movement. Now, this science seems to be emerging among brain scientists and other folks, and of course, exerciseologists and folks who work on that have been working on this a long time. But it looks like this science has sort of come together in what you might say is sort of a overall theory of human health.
Yeah, things are starting to come together. It's been a long sort of route to get there. I think for a long time, you know, science has thought about anything to do with the mind and is sort of based in the brain, and the brain is in control, and the brain is the sort of the supercomputer, and the body just sort of is like a meat suit that gets carried around and does what it's told. But I think that view is sort of starting to change, sort of partly because of things like embodied cognition, which is the idea that, you know, our body affects, and the way we use our body affects the way we think, and the language you use. So, for example, when somebody is becoming more successful, they're on the up, and when you get over something, you move on, you know, all these kind of ways we use language. The idea is that comes from the way we use our bodies to make sense of the world around us. And so things have started to change. And then over the past few years, there's just been, from all corners of science, people have been looking at the way that the body is connected to the brain. And it sort of surprised me, really, having looked at neuroscience as being a fully brain-based phenomenon, to realize this. But actually, when you think about it, when you move your body, I think a lot of people know implicitly, you know, you feel better. But now the science is starting to sort of plug into why that is and what are the connections and can we study them and see how to use them best.
So let's talk about the brain science role in advocating for more movement in our lives. I know at the beginning of the book, you talk about there's a new viewpoint on the role of the cerebellum. This is the smaller part of the brain down near the stem that I've always thought was about autonomic functions, you know, breathing, regulation, you know, just the sort of, it's like the engine room.
Well, yes,
it's a control room for the engine
room. So if you think of a diagram of the brain, there's a bit that hangs off the, it looks like it's hanging off the bottom of the brain. It looks like a different thing, like a little bit of cauliflower or something that's sort of dangling from the bottom. And for many, many years, it's been seen as having this role in sort of fine-tuning movements. So, I mean, I have a vested interest in this because my mother has a problem with her cerebellum, and you can really see that the first thing to go is balance and coordination, you know, to the point of, you know, speech and eye movements and everything. So it's the bit of the brain that, when you reach to grab a cup on the table, you don't have to really concentrate on where to put your hand. You sort of, it just corrects your movements. It's the sort of bit that when a ball comes flying at you, you just move your hand and you know where to catch the ball. But in recent years, so the last sort of 10, 15 years or so, people have started to realize that what the cerebellum does for our movements, it also does for our thoughts and our emotions. So it sort of fine tunes things and sort of just without us thinking, it sort of helps us put things in context. And one of the ideas about how movement is related to this is like an evolutionary point of view. And so in our evolutionary history, there was a point where our smaller primate ancestors sort of became too big and clumsy to be leaping around in the trees. So this is the sort of when the gibbons, the lesser apes, started to split off. And the solution to moving around in the trees without falling off was to hold on to branches with their hands, which sort of over millions of years evolved into sort of brachiation. So you know, think of a gibbon swinging through the trees. And at this point in evolution, the cerebellum got way, way bigger. And the idea is that it was to do with having to plan your movements as you move through the trees. So on the fly, having to make these calculations, oh, that's not going to work, better not hold that one, keep going, keep going. And that set the stage for further developments of thinking in sequence. So everything from making a plan to using a tool, you know, anything that involves this happens and then this happens and then this happens may have started with the way we moved through the trees, or not us, our ancestors.
And that cerebellum, that planning function, it also has a role on our intellectual function as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So the idea is that thoughts, you can think of thoughts almost as being actions that we haven't carried out with our bodies. So we think in this particular order, but the only difference between actually physically doing that in the world is that you're actually not physically doing it. So yes, thoughts. So there's this great quote, thoughts are movements that we haven't put into action. So yeah, it's just that the last stage of it hasn't happened.
One of the things your book, at the very end of the book, you talk about is how the COVID pandemic has sort of reinforced this idea of how important movement is in our life. Because when there was a lockdown, I mean, we were stuck at home. We probably spent more time sedentary than we normally are. And of course, we're a sedentary species for the most part, at least in the developed world, more often than not. What did we learn about movement and the importance of movement from these last few years?
Yeah, well, I mean, I, having spent most of the, when the lockdown happened, I was towards the end of writing the book. So I spent a lot of time thinking about movement and how it affects the way you feel and, you know, sort of trying to build that into my everyday life. But when the lockdown came, and in the UK, it was pretty severe at one point, you were only allowed outside once a day and you were only allowed outside to exercise. And that provided a really stark before and after of how movement can just change your outlook, you know, lift mood, help you think more clearly. Just because somehow being locked in the house and only being allowed to go out just kind of really brought it all into focus. So for example, one of the things that came out during my research is that when you move forwards through space physically, there's some really interesting psychological research that suggests that what happens is you feel as if you're moving through time. So we think of time as, you know, the past being behind us and the future being in front of us. And when we're physically moving forward through space, whether that's walking or running or cycling or anything, that it helps us feel like the future is closer and the past is further behind us. And so that's interesting for things like depression and, you know, feeling sort of stuck and unable to move on through life. And that physically moving forward can sort of give you that little almost an illusion that you're moving on mentally as well as physically. And I definitely found that that was really, really important just to get out and go somewhere so that you didn't feel so stuck sort of mentally and physically in your house.
Do you feel like there was a difference in attitude from those who used the lockdown as a period of sedentary time versus those that continue to get out and exercise and spend that time, as much time as they could outdoors, at least exercising?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think my family might be very unusual, but, you know, my husband usually commutes from where I live in the countryside to, or where we live in the countryside to London, which is about an hour and a half each way. And he used the time he would have been spent sitting on a train to go out for a swim or a run or a dog walk or whatever. But I know a lot of other people who didn't necessarily do that and said, oh, well, I just get out of my bed and I shower and I go and sit down and then I don't actually go anywhere. So it seems to be, there seems to be like a split. Some people just took it and went, yes, I know what I can do with this time. And I think it might be partly because people have had this idea of physical activity and exercise as being a thing that you do for your physical fitness, or you do because you're supposed to, or because you want to lose some weight, or because you want to look a certain way. And actually what we've forgotten is that doing any kind of physical activity, any form of movement, whether it's dance or, you know, just running around up and down your stairs a few times, can actually make you feel good. And so I think what's missing from people who haven't taken the opportunity is the knowledge that it will make you feel better, and that focus will improve, creativity will improve, mood will improve, which to me is an easier sell for people than just saying, well, you really should go out for a run. You know, you've got more time on your hands now.
I think your book also alludes to the fact that it preserves brain cognition and brain function.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's some quite stark statistics. So long-term brain imaging studies that followed people for, you know, a lot of years have found that decline in areas of the brain to do with memory, which is going to happen to some extent anyway with aging, but the rate of decline is steeper in people who are more sedentary. And that's not necessarily meaning the people who do the least exercise. So it was linked, that the link was with the amount of time spent sedentary rather than regardless of whether they did exercise at some point during the day. So it really isn't about going to the gym twice rather than once. It's more about moving more as part of your day, and reducing sitting time is really the important thing. So it's actually a lot more achievable than a lot of people might think.
We'll talk about that in just a second. My guest today is Caroline Williams, a science journalist and author and a regular contributor to The New Scientist. Her new book is titled Move, How the New Science of Body Movement Can Set Your Mind Free. Lots of research looking into how movement affects our emotional resilience, our creativity, and our mental outlook, as well as preserving brain function. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, for so many Americans, we spend an awful lot of time seated at a desk or at home on a couch. And even for those who exercise, it's a lot of times a lot of sitting, but a hard hour of cardio or strength training or running or other fitness training. And there's still a lot of desk time. So I think one of the things your book advocates for is a whole new paradigm on how we approach exercise and movement. Can you maybe tell us a little about that?
Yeah, so it's more about trying to build movement into your day however possible. So, you know, as a writer, I spend a lot of time sitting as well. And there were times when I was in the writing process when I just thought, oh, you know, who am I to be writing this? I've spent pretty much the whole day sitting. But, you know, there are ways of getting movement into your day. So, you know, every 20 minutes or so, take a stretch break, or go downstairs and put the kettle on, make yourself a cup of tea, or, you know, have a dance break, or, you know, even simple things like, especially if you work at home and you're not going to look strange by doing it. I spend a lot of time with my laptop, you know, sort of sitting or squatting on the floor, because that's an active way of being. So even sitting where you're not slouching and just, you know, collapsing under gravity, that's activating muscles, and that's sort of activating some of these pathways to make you just feel a bit more alert and think more clearly. So there are ways of getting it in. Taking movement breaks throughout the day is really, really important.
What about a standing desk? I mean, you know, that's sort of one of the new, you know, things that often you'll see around offices. Is that a better way to incorporate movement?
Well, I mean, in some ways, yes, because like then you do have to hold your posture, but it's still quite still. So I think it's probably better. But I mean, to me, I would be more inclined to take regular breaks where you actually have to go and do something rather than sort of stand still. And you know, someone asked me the other day about treadmill desks and these desks where you can sit on a bicycle and sort of go. And again, I kind of feel like that might feel like being a hamster on a wheel. And actually much better than that is to get a change of scenery, get the blood flowing, get out, if possible, go outside, would be a lot more productive way. And also I think one thing we do have to remember is that walking is a really good way to get creative juices flowing. You know, all the biggest thinkers of our time have sworn by going for a walk to clear that the mind. And there's some research to back that up now. So the idea is that when you go walking or do any movement that's at a pace that you feel is easy and you don't have to concentrate on, this sort of turns down activity in the bit of the brain behind the forehead called the prefrontal cortex. And that kind of keeps our brains on the straight and narrow, which is very useful when you're thinking logically. But if you want to think creatively, then turning activity down in that part of the brain is helpful. So if you can go for like a meander, go for a stroll or an easy cycle or something like that, that's one of the best ways to get your mind thinking creatively. So I think we have to get away from this idea that the best way to work is to sit at our desk and think. You know, maybe going for a walk round the block, that still counts as work. You know, and I work for myself and have done for the last, most of the past 20 years. And even I had to remind myself of that, that you don't have to be sitting down to be working. So I think a bit more flexibility in the workplace would be really, really helpful.
Yeah. You mentioned a walking pace of like 120 steps a minute. That sort of mimics your heartbeat. But also setting a pace in which you're walking easily, that you just mentioned, so that you're not concentrating on the physical activity, you're allowing your mind to completely wander.
Yeah, so those are sort of two different ways of walking to get different sort of mental results, if you like. So the meandering and letting your mind wander, that's, you know, just at your own pace and just, you know, wander and don't think about it is, you know, I mean, it is physical activity, but you can just let it happen. Whereas the 120 steps per minute, this is some really interesting research by a guy called Dick Green, who has found almost like pressure sensors in the bottoms of our feet. So when we put pressure on our feet under gravity and move, that sets up sort of turbulence in our blood vessels, which sends a boost of blood to the brain. And in his experiments, when there was a sweet spot when it was 120 steps per minute, which is quite a fast pace. That's not a meander, that's more of a march, yes. 2 steps per second. But when it was that about that speed, people's heartbeat tended to sync up with their step rate. And that was the best boost of blood that they could get to their brain. So it was kind of like a sweet spot for getting blood to the brain. And so what Green said about this was, well, maybe this explains why a brisk walk gives you this feeling of well-being and focus and alertness. So it's definitely worth a try. It's quite a march and it's not one to keep up for very long. But if you're sitting in your chair feeling a bit sort of lethargic and you just need to G things up a bit for a meeting that's coming up or something, then a quick blast of 120 steps per minute is definitely worth a try.
You know, when I read that, I was thinking of Harry Truman, the former U.S. president. He was famous for taking an hour-long walk every day while he was in the White House, after the White House, well into his 70s and 80s, at 120 steps a minute. He basically did a march for an hour.
Really?
Every single day.
Wow, he had this already sorted.
I know. But
wow.
Earlier you were talking about the fact that there are brain researchers investigating this. Are there many brain researchers looking at how exercise is affecting the brain today?
Yeah, and there's a surprising number. And so from all different angles. So there was one researcher I visited in Pittsburgh who is tracing neural connections from the body back to the brain to see where they end up and what that can tell us. And so he was looking at the stress system. So tracing connections from the adrenal glands, which sort of sit on top of our kidneys and pump out adrenaline and other stress hormones. And tracing back where that is connected to in the brain. And what they found was these connections turned up in the motor cortex, which is the bit that does voluntary movement. But more specifically, it was in the part of the motor cortex that moves the muscles of the core, the trunk. Mm. So given that we know already that, you know, body posture can make a massive difference to how you feel. I mean, there's been a lot of psychology experiments that have got people to do stressful tasks, like giving a short notice presentation. And, you know, this reliably gets people really stressed. If they have people prepare sort of slumped over, they get more stressed, they recover less quickly than if they're sort of standing upright. And this might explain why, but you can actually maybe use your core muscles as a way to inform your brain that actually you don't need to be freaking out. It might just regulate the stress system. And I found that really fascinating because I think so many solutions for stress are a variation of think yourself down, you know, calm down, think logically, how bad can it possibly be? Whereas actually the idea that you can just do something, engage your core, and you can do something physical to bring down your stress, that seems a lot more attractive to me. And it also explains things like Tai Chi and Pilates and yoga, you know, at least one aspect of why those things are so good for reducing stress.
You wrote in the book that, in fact, was it Harry Pilates, when he first started developing Pilates, said that this would reduce stress. he believed
yeah,
it
Joseph
from the
Pilates. Yeah,
Joseph
exactly.
Pilates.
So he said something. He said that spinal rolling and unrolling, so curling up and curling down, would ease nervousness and calm the nerves. Yeah, so he was basically saying the same thing. And I think for a lot of time, so even the researcher that was doing this work said, you know, he was often told to do Pilates to reduce his stress levels. And he was like, oh, for goodness sake, really? You know, what's doing that going to do for my stress levels? But actually, it seems that there is something behind it. And it's very early stage of research, and it's kind of got a long way to go before we can just say, absolutely, this is the smoking gun we've been looking for. But it's a really interesting avenue that they're kind of carrying on researching. So I'm going to watch that one very, very carefully.
My guest today is Caroline Williams, a science journalist and author. She's a regular contributor to The New Scientist, and her latest book is titled Move, How the New Science of Body Movement Can Set Your Mind Free. It's published by Hanover Square Press here in the U.S., and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, right along with Tai Chi on your core exercise, stretching, yoga, this is also important. What is the idea of stretching do for our brain health and our mental well-being?
Yes, stretching was a very, very interesting one, especially because I've had this sort of 10-year love affair with yoga, and it makes me feel great. And it was one of the things that made me start looking into movement in the first place. I would come home from yoga feeling calm and focused, and I thought, well, what is this? You know, why do I feel so much better afterwards? Is it the stretching? Is it the breathing? Is it the strength? What is it? You know, and in some ways, the answer is all of those things. But the stretching was fascinating because there is a line of research that has nothing to do with stretching the muscles, which is, I think, what we often focus on when we're thinking of stretching. And stretching does temporarily release tension in muscles when we've been sort of sitting scrunched up in a chair for a while. But there's another tissue that's been largely ignored until quite recently, called the fascia, which is basically slimy, sticky stuff that covers up, you know, it covers our muscles and helps them slide over each other, wraps our organs into neat little bags, and it's everywhere throughout our body. But research into what happens when we stretch this tissue is really interesting, because what seems to happen is that the cells that are part of the tissue seem to get longer, and the tissue relaxes and also secretes chemicals which decrease inflammation, which is a really interesting thing. Inflammation is linked to everything from stress, depression, heart disease, diabetes. Inflammation is one of those sort of mind-body conditions that seems to link a lot of things, and there's a lot of research into it at the moment. And so it seems that something very important is happening when this tissue is stretched. And also it's quite a sponge-like structure. So we recently had the technology to be able to look at the fascia in situ within the body. And it turns out to be quite sponge-like. It's fluid-filled. And when we move it, it seems that kind of fluid gets squeezed out the sponge and into the lymphatic system, where it can be sent along to, you know, the rest of the immune system and cleaned up. So it just seems that there's something very interesting about these tissues that maybe, I'm not talking about getting your leg behind your head necessarily, but just taking the body through the range of motion and just letting all this stuff squeeze and move along in ways that I used to roll my eyes about when I went to yoga, and they'd say, oh, right, squeeze the toxins out of your muscles and give your organs a little massage. And I think, oh, for goodness sake, you know, why would your body need your organs to be massaged? You know, your body has put them in bony cages for a reason. They don't need a massage. But actually, when you think of it in terms of moving and stretching and just not being left still and with nothing going on, it makes a lot more sense. It kind of doesn't feel so quite so far-fetched.
Now, there's one other area that you focus on, and that is breathing. And the idea of breathing and regulating your breath to, say, 6 breaths a minute, deep breathing, can really have a major effect. Talk a little bit about breathing.
Yeah, so breathing, it doesn't immediately seem like much of a, you know, a movement sort of thing, but we are about the only creature that can voluntarily have as much control over our breathing. So the rate and the depth of our breathing. And the 6 breaths a minute is very interesting, because on some level, humanity's worked out a long time ago that this is a very calming rate to breathe. So there's studies that looked at the chanting of the rosary in Latin and chanting prayers as well, and various types of worship seem to get people breathing at 6 breaths per minute, which might explain why, you know, that they're very, very calming. So the science behind that is that 6 breaths per minute not only increases the it's the most efficient way of getting oxygen into your bloodstream, but also it activates the vagus nerve, which is part of the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the calm down response. So it just tells the body that everything is safe and you can stand down the stress response and everything can go back to normal. So there's something magic about this 6 breaths per minute. And people in studies as well, when they've been asked to breathe at different rates, they consistently rate 6 breaths per minute as the most calming rate of breathing. So it's something that anyone can do at any time. You don't even need to let anyone sitting around you know that you're doing it. And it can really just bring a little bit of peace into the day. So yeah, that's a very easy take, I think.
And you also recommend, and scientists are beginning to recommend, breathing through your nose as much as possible. Try to avoid breathing through your mouth. Now, we've known the dental aspects of that for many years. Dentists will tell you, don't breathe through your mouth. But there's also other health benefits.
Yeah, so the link between breathing and the brain, it sort of comes from, I mean, it kind of makes sense when you kind of think it through. So when you're breathing in air from the environment, if you're thinking of it as an animal survival point of view, so what you need to know from what's coming through your nose is this environment safe to move around in, or is it dangerous and I need to get out of here now? And so when these scents come in through our nostrils, they go to the part of the brain that processes odors. And to make sense of that information, what the brain needs to do is to sort of start. So brain waves are the electrical activity going through the brain. And if the brain needs to share information, it helps if the information is sort of on the same wavelength, literally in the brain. And so what happens is from this scent processing region, areas that are involved in memory and making sense and fear responses and all that kind of thing, they start to sort of oscillate at the same brainwave frequency. And so if you don't breathe through your nose, that whole beautiful cascade of your brain sort of syncing up and sort of getting on the same wavelength doesn't happen. So if you want to change the way your brain is processing and get it onto a nice, slow sort of rate of breathing, get your brainwaves calmed, then that'll only work if you do it through your nose. So yeah, the yogis have been right about that as well. So they've been saying that for a long time, but it turns out that science is now agreeing with them.
And science continues to do work. There's much more to read in the book, Move, How the New Science of Body Movement Can Set Your Mind Free, and filled with clinical research, which is sort of proving a lot of these old adages that people have been saying for a long time. Interesting book. Caroline, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been lovely.
Caroline Williams is a science journalist and author and a regular contributor to New Scientist. Her latest book is titled Move, How the New Science of Body Movement Can Set Your Mind Free. It's published by Hanover Square Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.